Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
Welcome to Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson, the podcast for people who like to listen to things. Things that Tom says, things that Tom's guests have to say. It's the podcast that gives and gives and gives and doesn't expect anything in return. Okay, that's not really true, but it's free. Anyway, here's Tom.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Guess what? Yes, I'm him. I'm Tom Wilson, and welcome to a fabulous, fabulous podcast that I apologize for right off the bat, because maybe it's not going to be that fabulous. But here's the thing. For you guys who have been here before, you know, I just go for it here. And for those who are new, welcome. And again, sorry about that. But welcome to another magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder and enchantment as we flit and float and fly, but not in the way they did it in that Sound of Music song where they, I flit, I float, I fly. No, I meant it in a different way. I meant it in a manly and a handsome way. Although ladies could like it that way too, like Irish Spring soap in that that soap commercial. I've now just, gone back to soap commercials in 1983 for references. Thanks. See, you see what I told you? We're off on the right foot. Skill in broadcasting. This is another one of those podcasts with a guest. I'll tell you what's happening with me. Ethan Luck was a guest a few weeks ago, the drummer for the fabulous band Reliant K. I went out and saw a few shows, the House of Blues. Where was I? Anaheim. I saw William Beckett, a fabulous, fabulous young songwriter and singer. Check out William Beckett Music, I believe, .com. Isn't that right? I had it written down here somewhere. Yes, William Beckett Music .com. Check out William Beckett, because I found him great. I found him as many, many of the young, hip, together singer songwriters of our contemporary culture. I found him charming, I found him talented, and I found him really skinny. So, hey, how do these guys, sorry, but it's almost like a biological question that I have. How do you continue to function being that thin? I mean, it's very photogenic, and it's very, and that's, look, that's how big you are. As I say to many people, especially when I sit down in an airplane and the person next to me is just going, oh dear, you know, I say, I'm sorry, God made me this big. This is the way it is. And I know William Beckett and all you, and all of you, very thin yet lithe, you're limber, You limber people that yes, you were made that way. But I think it's a wonderful science experiment as I stare at you thinking, wow, look at that. How can you be that thin and still converse and lift guitars and hydrate? Because those are things I saw William do. I saw him converse with me, and I saw him play the guitar and sing, and I saw him hydrate, drink some water, and he was able to do all of those things without any help from the medical staff. He continued to play, and he played very well. I'm kidding with William, but I found him really talented, and I hope that you check out his music as well as Reliant K's music. There's so much. Isn't it wonderful that there's so much exciting, wonderful music being played and people sharing their arts? I've been, as I've said before in the podcast, I'm always inspired, enthused, kind of amazed by the letters, the emails I get from people giving me a slice of their life, and that they enjoy the podcast, And I'm glad. And this is another, this is a slice of life interview. Bob Bledsoe, I've known for a long time. I've seen him in videos. I've seen him on sketches on YouTube. He's an actor. He works in commercials. He works on episodic television, in movies. He's a writer. He writes screenplays. He does a lot in Hollywood to make a living. And like so many others, and even, hey, let's face it, like me, a lot of people don't know him or don't know his name or say, hey, were you on a thing with the guy? I recognize. Did you go to my high school? So I thought it would be interesting to hear from Bob, a guy who goes to auditions, who, you know, gets a job in this commercial or that, who writes screenplays, and you guys out there, you think about how do you do it? Like, what do you do? What do you do when you wake up? This is one of those people, unheralded for right now, but a very talented writer, an excellent actor. I've always been struck by his naturalistic approach. He's very, well, people would call it organic as an actor, which people used to say that a lot about my acting. Until I put a lot of shtick in it. But no, organic acting, people would say, boy, you're so organic with it. Organic acting to me always seemed like if your neck itches during the scene, you just scratch your neck. If you felt like sitting down at a point, you sit down. Just to me, that always seemed like the way people live. And my job was to make this scene in the movie or TV show or commercial or whatever seem like just a guy living and doing this stuff and things happening to. Now, I know that is not the approach of a movie star. The approach of a movie star is a completely different thing. And even, I think, you know, George Clooney had a story about Steven Spielberg and them talking about how movie stars act. It's very different. And if you watch them, they're very still. They just don't move their arms a lot. They're just kind of standing there saying, love me, camera. Love me a lot. Well, I can't really do that. I can't stand there and just say, love me, camera. So I have to act like a guy because really I'm going to be playing the guy. I'm going to be playing the cop that arrests the guy. I'm going to be playing the thug who mugs the guy. I'm going to be playing the dad who hears about the police report from the police. I'm going to be the disgruntled coach. I'm going to be many, many things. But they have to live within a naturalistic, quote unquote, organic performance. I love this interview years ago with Harrison Ford, where I think Harrison Ford was a contract player at a movie studio right at the end of that era when you could be, you know, under contract at MGM or whatever. He was under this talent contract. And, of course, I'll get the story wrong, but let me paraphrase it. And he was playing like the delivery guy of something at a house. And one of the studio people brought him in to talk about his performance or whatever, and said, you know, when you walk up that thing, delivering the thing, you just don't think, wow, there's a star. And Harrison Ford said, I thought you were supposed to think, wow, there's the delivery boy. So, you know, he was playing a delivery boy. He was delivering something. Like how delivery people are, you know. So, but when you do that, and it's very naturalistic, the other actors say, "Boy, that was so organic." When I did what? You know, when you put your hand in your pocket. Oh, I was just looking for a Tic Tac. You know, whatever. Anyway, so this is my conversation with actor, writer, comedian, and ukuleleist Bob Bledsoe.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Bob Bledsoe's here on the podcast. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah.
So so coming up to this fabulous palatial apartment here that you're what sublet your house sitting.
Super palatial that I'm housing.
It is
at.
Super palatial.
Yeah.
Are we in Moscow?
Well,
right now?
Here's the thing is you don't know this because this is the first time you've seen this place, but I have dressed the set to be an exact replica of WKRP. And I did that for you. That's why.
Nice.
That's why I'm dressed like
Lonnie
Venus Flytrap.
Oh, I thought
you went Lonnie Anderson.
I thought I went Lonnie.
That was better.
I jumped on you because I thought you were going Howard Hessman. Right. So I went, boom, Lonnie Anderson. I'm going to beat him to the punch. You have been in L.A. Far shorter a period of time than I have.
5 minutes. So,
just here.
Yeah, just
really.
Here.
You got a nice place. We are in an undisclosed location.
Yes, we are.
But it is in Koreatown,
mm-hmm.
in Los Angeles.
That's right.
So you have an affinity for cement floor departments and taekwondo, apparently.
That's right. That's right. I've learned a lot about Koreans. Here's what I found out about Koreans that I didn't know. Maybe you did because you might be more world-traveled than me.
I'm a jet setter.
Koreans are beautiful people. I go to the little Korean market down the street,
yeah.
and it's like models in there. They're tall.
Oh, you mean physically attractive
yes. people. Tall, the men, the women, everybody. Just absolutely beautiful people, the Koreans. And I would have never known that because I'm one of those people, I try not to be racist, but I just lump Asians all into one, and I can't really tell the difference. But since I've been here in Koreatown for a little while, I'm noticing.
No, there are many, many significant differences.
Yeah.
Not that
yeah.
I'm spelling them all out on the podcast, but yes, Koreans are very... very a distinct Asian sub-community certainly yes. here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
And but very few North Koreans.
Yeah, not a whole lot.
South Koreans, very attractive. North Koreans, very attractive, yet thin.
Right, right.
Very, very thin.
And the thing is, you don't want to ask them. You don't want to ask North or South. It's considered.
I don't think there are any North Koreans here.
No. That's what I found.
One of those
they're
balloon,
not.
Some balloon when people were escaping from East Germany and stuff.
Right, right.
Whatever. There was a guy who actually worked in a raincoat factory. And over years, he just stole like one raincoat at a time. They were made of rubber. And he was melting them together to make a balloon to escape from East Germany. And he did it successfully.
No, wait. You're telling me this
is
a true story?
This is a true story. A true story.
What?
Back when the wall was...
He melted raincoats and made a balloon?
Sometimes we forget these things since... You know, the world has just blossomed with peace and harmony among
right.
all people, as
of
we can clearly see.
Yeah.
But at one time, when East and West Germany were separated by that famous wall, it was you risked your life to go near that wall, and the guy had collected. I just like that story when I was a teenager in high school, and the guy had collected the rubber raincoats in order to melt them together, so he had a giant raincoat umbrella, and one day he took off, trusting the winds, and actually escaped.
That's like a children's story. I mean, other than the horribleness and what he was escaping.
Other than the
he melted raincoats
other
together.
Other than the cop shooting at you right at the end.
Right.
Saying, stop! That's not the best chapter of the children's book, but that was a true story.
Wow, that's amazing.
And how did we get to East Germany from Korea? I don't know, but they're lovely people.
Yep.
And the North
Good
Koreans
folks.
Are thin and lovely, so they are the supermodels.
Right, right.
Where did you grow up, Bob?
I grew up in Spokane, Washington. And back to the other thing, I've been here about 6 years, maybe 7 years is really how long I've been in L.A. But I grew up in Spokane, Washington.
And what did you do? What did Dad do?
Dad was a realtor, mortgage broker.
Is Dad still with us? Dad's
still around. Mom's still around.
Still doing
still
realty up there?
He just got out of the mortgage business during the mortgage crash. He kind of got out because it slowed way down. And now he does... He helps businesses with their websites and Google optimization and things like that. He's like an internet tech guy, and he's an old man. And my mom's helping him. Like, it's these two elderly people in a house doing internet stuff. By the way, if you look at my website, my mom did most of that. I call my mom. I try to do it myself, but I never know how. So I call my mother to have her help me do my website.
So they have this little picket fence in Spokane, and she by day she bakes cookies,
right?
And Dad waves at cars passing by.
Yep.
And he has an Arnold Palmer or something, you know, a little lemonade with some iced tea in it. And then by night they go into the command center or something, something in the basement with lots of screens everywhere.
Tons of screens everywhere. And mom was a nurse. She worked as a nurse and she trained nurses. She taught nursing at a college and now she's out of that. And they both do
Were you a performer and writer and comedian in high school or school? Were you the class clown guy?
Yeah.
Or did this come later?
Well, no, I think I was, but what happened was when I was in grade school, I became the class clown because I had all kinds of random learning disabilities. Like I had slight dyslexia, and so I had a hard time reading, and I had all kinds of memory problems. I couldn't remember anything. So I sort of became the class clown so that I wouldn't be thought of as the idiot. I was kind of thought of as the funny guy. And then in about junior high, that stuff, I just kind of grew out of that, which apparently happens with a lot of people with learning disabilities. They just grow out of it. And I ended up doing well in school and being sort of the sports guy. I was kind of a jock.
So let me just add, so do you remember a time when words were making sense to you? I mean, does that begin to strike you? I mean, are we talking about like brain synapses or something? Do you know some? I mean, did you start saying in the sixth grade or the eighth grade, whatever, Mom, I can read better now, or stuff is beginning to make more sense?
Almost. I mean, I know when it was. Exactly when it was. It was the summer between my sixth and seventh grade year. Sixth grade, I struggled, couldn't remember anything, it wasn't that I couldn't read. I didn't have terrible dyslexia, but mm-hmm. I read slowly, and spelling was a big problem. I had a hard time spelling. But it wasn't severe dyslexia. It just gave me a hard time. But then I hit seventh grade, junior high, and I think I had a really good summer that year too. My self-esteem, I think a lot of learning disability has to do with self-esteem. Mm-hmm. My self-esteem was boosted a little bit that summer, and I got into seventh grade, and school was like I was getting A's and B's, and you know I got mostly A's and B's all through school and high school. I ended up being the student body president as a senior in high school, and
you said you were a jock guy. Your friends? You were in the jock group?
Yeah, but I was kind of friends with a lot. I didn't really hang out in one group. I was friends with other people. Uh-huh. I mean, I loved heavy metal music, so I was kind of – I had friends that were sort of those kind of guys.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And would you do play football or wrestle?
Yeah, all that.
But what did you do? Play football, wrestle, whatever. Badminton. Yeah, all that, whatever.
No,
paddle, ball, whatever it was.
Whatever they were
offering.
I just
picked it up and threw it.
Here's the thing. I did not enjoy sports as much as I think other kids did. I did it because it helped with popularity, and I think that's what I was that's what I was sort of going for then. And that's also, this was my point of being class clown. Once I was getting attention because I was a good wrestler, like in junior high, and a decent football player, I was getting that kind of attention, so I sort of pulled back on the comedy. I think I still was sort of a funny guy. But I wasn't. I was more interested in sort of being a jock. But I was also in choir. And I can't sing. If you ask me to sing now, it's terrible. But in junior high, I was in choir and I did solos and everything because I loved being in front of the audience.
Uh-huh.
Even though they were probably bad, I don't think I have any of them on videotape. But if we watched them, it'd probably be terrible.
So you liked being in front of the audience in junior high, but then in high school, you started to make this decision. Like I think I've got to be in the jock group, or I think I've got to be a little stoic. I have to have the stoicism of the varsity football player.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was doing. I mean, I still, I still liked speaking in front of people. I remember when I was in high school, I worked in a movie theater, and I would get in trouble for making announcements to the people. like I was just a what do you call it? The guys who clean up the theater. Not a busboy, cleaning guys. Yeah. An usher. They called us an usher, right?
Yes, an usher.
But basically, we just clean up the thing. But if there was a theater packed with people and we were 2 minutes late running the thing, I'd go up to the front and go, "Hey, folks, I work here and just wanted to let you know, sorry that we're running a little bit late. We're going to get this running for you in like a minute or so." And then I'd see a manager come in and go, Bob, come on, you don't have to say anything. But I loved talking to people, you know. So.
Well, that's good. Did you perform in high school? I mean, did you – no more choir after – but did performing come in?
Performing didn't come in until I was a banker. I was a mortgage guy. I followed in my father's footsteps.
Really? Did you go to college after high school?
I
got a job at the bank?
I took some courses, uh-huh. real estate type courses, but I basically went straight into doing mortgage loans. And a few years into it, I thought, man, I mean, I was okay at it. I made some decent money here and there. But I realized that it just wasn't me. Like I cannot sit in an office and do this.
So it was a later realization to you then.
It
to
was
kind of start. Start being creative,
it,
or start
it was.
Getting in front of people. Start it, performing.
Yeah, I mean, here's what happened. I was in my early 20s, and I don't remember exactly how old, but I had sort of started to become the class clown again. Like I would go to parties,
at the mortgage broker things.
At the mortgage broker things, I would do impressions of guys that would come into our office. Everybody thought it was funny when we'd go have beers. I'd be the funny guy, and everybody kept saying, "You should do stand up. You should be a stand up comic." And so one day when I was sort of doing this soul searching, like, what am I going to do? I know that I can't be a mortgage guy. I got to do something else. I thought, oh, yeah, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a stand-up comic. Maybe I should just do that. So I was living in Spokane at the time and moved to Seattle to be a stand-up comic. And
you just packed all your stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
You weren't performing in Spokane. I mean, you really packed the car. Like, I was a mortgage broker, but I'm packing the suitcase and mom and dad, I'm going to be a stand-up comic.
Yeah, but I'm still a mortgage guy. I mean, I took a job in Seattle and still did mortgage loans for years while I developed my act. But mm-hmm. Seattle had comedy clubs and Spokane didn't.
Right.
So, you know, I just developed my act and started taking acting classes because I thought that comedians must take acting classes and later learned that they really don't. Most of them don't do that. But I'm glad I did because it got me some acting work here and mm-hmm. there. So,
well, most, you know, a lot of comedians aren't very good actors.
Yeah,
I mean, I used to rail against that, you know, many years ago because I did stand up and I was an actor, and everyone would do that kind of, oh, comedians can't act, and I would be angry. Well, you know, let me audition for it. Let me show you something. But then, as years and years and years went on, and I watched so many comedians act, I had to come to the realization, those people were kind of right.
Yeah.
They can't. I mean, they were right to assume that I couldn't.
It's unfortunate because it is kind of a stigma. And what I think it is, I've met enough comedians who get into stand-up comedy, and I think that either, A, they think that they're so talented with their comedy that that's going to put them on film or screen. Just like a very pretty girl who doesn't think she needs acting classes because she's so pretty, they'll put her on screen. Or they're very insecure and they know that they're good at comedy, but they're not as secure with their acting, so they just won't do it. You know, they're
right.
just scared to put that out there.
Well, I think it's just fear.
Yeah.
Most of it.
Yeah.
It's just fear at being humiliated, which is you're the control guy anyway, which put the microphone in your hand.
Right.
Because you were insecure, so you decided, hey, in order to be secure, I'll get up in front of people and hold the microphone and I'll kind of run the ship.
Right.
So that, you know, so that I can control things
yeah.
and not feel that fear or not feel so insecure.
Right.
But then it's very insecure to be acting in a script, I think, and the joke is not coming for a minute and a half. And we have to sit here and be natural with each other.
Right.
And act like real people in a scene. And I know that the joke is when, you know, your girlfriend walks through the door and trips over that flower pot that we put there on the last page. But we've got to do this exposition, this natural thing, just living as people
right.
before the joke comes.
Right.
And comedians often, I think, are like, when's the joke here? When's the joke here? It's just set up and then joke.
Exactly. That's why it's tough to do improv with straight stand-up comedians.
Because, well, yeah, absolutely. Because they will – they're excellent, in fact, at getting to that line, which is the joke.
Mm-hmm.
But then they will look off stage and wonder, why isn't anyone turning off the lights now?
Right,
because
right.
people should applaud or something, and you have to live beyond the joke in
right.
an improv.
Right. They're not moving the scene forward. They're not helping their scene partners. They're just –
I'm there
the every time.
To just hop in and supply the funny line
right.
that will, you know, hopefully stop this scene.
Right. And please, can I supply the funny line before my scene partner does?
right.
Let me just get there.
We're in a race. Well, that's natural. You yeah. know, everybody, every comedian on stage is in a race with the other comedians to get to where the joke was.
Right. right.
I mean, if I, you know, I stepped on you to get to Lonnie Anderson.
No, I think I stepped on you to get to Venus Flytrap.
Really? But that was an example yeah. for our listeners right. to know that if both guys, it's so funny, if three are here, if five are here, here, the race is even more crazy.
Yes.
But both of us realize that you went to WKRP in Cincinnati as the set at your apartment, and both of us, our brains start spinning to characters in WKRP. And when is it going to come up? Boom, Lonnie Anderson. You know, it's nice to see you dressed like Lonnie Anderson, whatever.
Right.
That you're in a race.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been very busy here in L.A. Did you come to L.A. as a stand-up then? Things go well in Seattle. You start doing stand-up. You get spots. It starts going well enough. Did someone in Seattle say, hey, man, that's good. You should think about the big leagues? Or did you come to Seattle going, hey, I realize this is AAA ball, but I'm here to go to the majors?
Yes, both.
Okay.
I'll tell you this without making it too long of a story. But when I got to Seattle, it wasn't I'm going to try stand up comedy. It was I'm going to be a stand up comedian. I know that I'm the funniest guy within the group of people that I know. I went to a few comedy clubs in Seattle, and I would sit there. They were open mics. I would sit there and I'd go, okay, I think I'm funnier than that guy. I'm pretty sure I'm not funnier than that guy, but maybe with some work, I think I could do a better act than that guy. So I sort of gauged how I might do. And then I wrote a half an hour worth of material before I stepped on stage. Half an hour, whittled it down to my top 3 minutes, rehearsed it at home, and then took that to open mic. Because that's what I thought you were supposed to do. And I did well my first time on stage.
I'm not surprised.
Because of that.
Yep.
I didn't realize that other people write 3 minutes of material that they're not sure about, invite all their friends there so there's more pressure, and then try out their material.
And 45 seconds of that works. And for the rest of the time, they're pacing on stage saying, so what else is going
right,
on?
Exactly. I love this. So what else is
so
going on?
So what else is going on?
Right. So to get to the point, I my first time on stage was great. I bombed a number of times after that. You know, it wasn't all great. But the point is that I did stand up for a number of years in Seattle and got a little bit of attention. Like I would have other comics from L.A. come up and I would maybe feature for them or something.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And they would go, oh, man, you should be in L.A. You should come down. You're doing commercials and stuff up here, right? You should come down to L.A. And then someone, like I remember, I can't remember the guy's name, but somebody who worked for Overbrook Entertainment for Will Smith's production company mm-hmm. was up there scouting, and I was like his favorite comic in Seattle, and he gave me his card, and he goes, hey, let me know if you're ever in L.A. So I started coming down here and showcasing at the Improv, which...
Oh, in little forays.
Yeah.
Just coming down from Seattle and just getting some stage time in L.A.
To get some stage time in mm-hmm. L.A., yeah, yeah. And it would always be for a showcase for someone that wanted to see me, I would come down. So for a comedian in Seattle,
that's pretty significant.
It's a big deal. I've since realized that you get those all the time, and it's not that big of a deal. I mean, it's just another set. They don't always lead to anything. But I came down here with a few people knowing me. I got some meetings at network, casting. I met with Grace Wu over at NBC when she was the head of casting there, and a couple other people when I first moved here. So that was.
And you started working down here at the Improv mostly.
No, I didn't. I did sets at the Improv, but it wasn't like I've never been that comic that's constantly out trying to get stage time. And I probably should do that more, but I'm not. Like I.
Well, what's your business approach?
It's
to comedy.
It's this that I came down here to be an act to transition into acting and writing,
uh-huh.
and I still do stand up, and I'll do pretty much anytime I'm booked. I'll accept it and go do a show, but. I wake up really early in the morning and start writing scripts, and then I'll have auditions and things like that. And for me, at least, being a comedian that's out till 3 a.m. doesn't mesh with the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So
you're missing so many useless conversations over sandwiches.
I know.
At all night diners.
I know, and I'm missing so many conversations about comedians and what they have going on. Like hearing everything. Sometimes I feel like I probably should be out there more. Maybe I should be hanging out at the Improv and doing sets as much as possible. But, the other thing is I decided when I moved here that I wouldn't go on the road doing stand-up. I wanted mm-hmm. to be here for auditions and, mm-hmm. and, meetings and things like that. And because I chose to do that, I've done a number of TV shows and movies and things. And I've got a lot of comic friends who are very talented that live in LA. They've never been on television, never gotten a movie because they're always on the road doing stand-up.
Right, right.
But then there,
and that was my approach as well when I was starting out in LA. Was I saw a lot of guys making good money and driving a nice car, and just not be here when anything was auditioning.
Right.
You know, they weren't here.
Right.
They were in Des Moines, Iowa, making money at a steakhouse, which gave them money to come back to LA and have a way nicer apartment than I did and a way nicer car. But I was here.
Right. Right.
I was here just doing spots in LA and being able to go to that audition or meet with that writer or whatever during the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wanted to talk to you for many reasons, because every time we've talked, we've had interesting conversations, and I just find you an interesting guy. But what's fascinating to me is in not being in LA for too long a period of time and approaching the entertainment industry relatively freshly over the past 6 years, where a lot has happened. I mean, there have been sea changes in the way that people get entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the 6 years that you've lived in Los Angeles, part of that being good and liberating and giving the ability to get your trade out there in doing video or anything and getting on the internet, and a part of it being really confusing because of the monetization of the internet. Like, how do you perform now and write now and pay for stuff?
Yeah, it's you're right. In just the time that I've been here, 6 or 7 years, there have been huge, drastic changes. I mean, forget the writer strike that happened right after I got here.
Right.
But you know, one of the other things is, I feel like anything. Well, I'll tell you this: anything that I've ever gotten, as far as a pilot or some like a really great manager or something like that, anything I've ever gotten like that has been from a video that I did and put up on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Something that somebody saw that I did myself, not just that I happened to be cast in something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important now to be doing your own stuff, and it's not hard to do. I mean, you can do really great things on zero budget.
But your approach to the entertainment industry, I only assume, has to be balanced between so many things.
Yes.
Between doing videos for free and writing spec scripts that you're not sure if anything will happen from this, and then having meetings, as we all have, with various networks pitching shows and everything. I mean, is that mm-hmm. your experience now?
It's totally my experience now. It's constantly always trying to put videos together. Although I did less of that in the last year, but there's a bunch online.
Because I met you, you were doing acting roles in the Kyle Cease videos. That's where we met, isn't it, initially?
Yeah, we were.
But, I mean, you were standout on those. Even those, I mean, the tiny little videos that went onto the internet, but you were really funny in them.
Thanks.
And had a very natural quality. I mean, your acting was good.
Thanks.
Even in a 3-minute silly little video.
Thanks. Yeah, that's the thing, is you got to show your stuff, whether
right.
it's your writing or your acting or whatever. But
and from then you made your own?
From then, yeah. And some of those Kyle Cease videos were ones that I had written and so we sort of improvised through. So some of those were what I consider to be my, like, that's my video. I sort of created that. But we, you know, in creating these videos, we all improvise our way through it. You
right,
know?
Right.
And then some of them were just, hey, Bob, we need you to do this role in this little video
sure.
that we did. And so we did
what
that.
Is something that people might look up representational of, something that you're happy with?
Well, if they go to YouTube and just type in The Program Show, just uh-huh. youtube.com/The Program Show, that's my sketch channel.
Oh, okay.
On YouTube, and there's a bunch of sketches.
Uh-huh.
We did I did a Miracle Whip parody commercial that has been pretty popular. It's got, I don't know, 120,000 views or something, but there are people who believe that it's a real Miracle Whip commercial, and they're mad because the tagline at the end is Miracle Whip, if you don't like it, get the fuck out. And they think that Miracle Whip actually did put that out.
Oh, so they're insulted thinking that that's the Miracle Whip people.
The Miracle Whip people are cussing now in their videos, which is really funny. But so there's that. And then there's a when you go to that page, the video that auto plays is actually more of a short film. It's like 8 minutes long. But this was one that I had that I co-directed with a friend of mine who's a big action director in Italy, and he was just heading off to go and direct a movie, and he had some crew and he had all this equipment that, and we shot this video the day before he left, and it looks, I mean, we shot it like an action movie basically. It looks awesome, and we did it on no budget.
How do you meet an Italian action movie director?
I mean, what, through my ex-girlfriend, her, who I'm still very close with, her best friend married him, and so we just, you know, I've been to parties at their houses and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And he's super talented. He's known for Italian television, which is kind of, to me, Italian television is like Miami Vice was in the 80s, where it's like boats jumping off things and flying through the air and explosions and stuff. Right. That's the kind of stuff he directs.
And still Don Johnson.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
In Italy.
Yes. Right. Exactly. So basically, I said, Giorgio, let's shoot this. I'll handle the comedy, and I'll direct anything that has to do with comedy. You do that. Just shoot it like it's an action movie, just like you would. And he did a brilliant job. It was really good.
So as many people ask me, and I've even talked about it on the podcast, the curiosity that people have, like, what do you do, you know, as the person? Because they feel like it can feel to them, to that person working in Chicago, as an incredibly unserious thing to do. I am deciding to make videos and to write funny things and to act in other people's videos and maybe to be in movies or not, but to follow this path. But there is a lot of work in it. So how does Bob, you know, make money to buy food?
Well, he doesn't always. Is a really good answer, really solid answer. But you know, it comes from, you know, most of the things that I do, I don't necessarily get paid for. But you know, I get acting roles here and there on TV shows, movies, commercials. Commercials bring in residuals, and that's how you make.
Yeah.
You end up making so much more money in commercials than you do maybe on a TV show or something.
Right.
At least at the level that I do them. Where
so
I,
you're out
where
there auditioning. You're actively auditioning for commercials.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's auditioning, and then it's occasionally doing stand-up. You know, I'll get the occasional stand-up gig here and there that I will go and do. I'll go on the road once or twice a year. I'll fly into a club and do it, you know.
Because I'm only asking, Bob, but, well, first of all, as I said, because people ask me the same question. And secondly, yes, so much quote-unquote work now is for people expecting you to do it for free.
Right, exactly.
I mean, the percentage of those emails that you get, hey, I would like you to be in this thing, and previously you would sort of pursue it, and maybe it would be a low-budget movie that you get paid very little on or something. But now it seems like the preponderance of things is just, oh, we thought you'd just do it because it would be fun.
Right, right. Well, that's true. And
or, quote-unquote, good exposure.
Yeah.
You're like, dude, who's watching this?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. The nice thing is I've done enough stuff online now that's a good representative of my work that I tend to get hired occasionally to, like, right now I've been hired not for a lot of money, but I get hired to direct a music video for these guys. Uh-huh. And so I'm doing that, and occasionally I'll get hired to write something. I'll get hired to write a movie based on somebody's treatment or write a sketch or punch something up or whatever. So you do these little jobs here and there.
So like so many performers, you are cobbling together a reasonable living, but doing myriad things, doing a million different things.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever comes up. Yeah. I mean, you are auditioning for a cheese commercial. As I've talked about in the podcast, auditioning for toilet paper commercial, whatever, you end up to be the guy going, boy, I feel much better now that I used it.
Now that I used this.
Yeah.
And then, cheese or toilet paper?
Right. Whichever. And and the next day, auditioning for some dramatic thing in a movie or TV show as disgruntled dad in SVU.
Right. And then in the afternoon, trying to storyboard a screenplay that you're trying to write as a spec. And and then meeting with someone who
is one really taking off for you that you feel, or still you're juggling, you know, flaming clubs and just you know just trying to pay for stuff and seeing what happens.
Yeah, I mean it all depends. It's weird. Hollywood is weird, as you know, in that you could have nothing going on and then one day somebody calls you and says, "I want you to be in my show," and or "I want to buy your screenplay," or whatever. And I've learned that 9 out of 10 of those scenarios don't work out. Like when somebody calls me and says, "Hey, I've got this really great thing for you. It's going to mean a lot of money. We just need to sort of push it through." It's probably not going to work out, but there's a chance, and you have to sort of chase it. So I go from thing to thing, whether it's, last year I had there was a potential that I was going to sell a movie that I had written that was pretty big. And so if you would ask me that question, I would say, oh, the writing is really taking off for me. Just recently, I won't mention the details, but we talked about it before. I had a TV show that it looked like I was being offered a TV show. And, so I would have said, "Oh no, I'm a host now. I'm a television host. That's what's mm-hmm. really taken off." But they don't necessarily work out. So I would say that my writing has gotten a lot better. There's a lot of projects that I'm doing. I get hired occasionally for writing, and I only write so that I can act. I always write myself in something because I would if I
yeah,
had
what's
my choice,
the one what's the one that you love?
If I had my choice, I would just be an actor. I would just be on camera as an actor, and
why
I would do
that?
Stand up.
Why is that? Do you think?
It's easier than writing for me.
Ease.
It is.
I'm looking for ease, Tom. You get to act the scene and then go have snacks.
Right, and eat snacks. I love snacks. It's not that I'm looking for something easy. It's just that writing to me, I feel like I'm good at writing, but it is a struggle for me to get things written. You know, it's. I do it and I struggle through it and I get it done and I usually like what I've written, but it's difficult to do. Whereas acting, you get to go on a set and you make all these friends and you get to go and hang out in your trailer, and I get to play my ukulele in my trailer for hours and then go on set and I've memorized some lines and I play, you know.
Well, you're really denigrating what I do for a living. You're really bringing me down here. Because man, I was just playing the ukulele in my trailer 2 days ago.
Really?
I literally was. But I'm cutting this out of the podcast. I'm not letting people know that.
No, of course.
That
of
I
course
actually take free snacks to my dressing room and just play the ukulele.
That's, you know what? If we had a dressing room together, if we had those.
Awesome.
It'd be so good. I did a movie earlier this year where the guy, you know, we were in those little, what do you call them? Honey bucket trailers with
honey wagons
yeah. that have the partition that you yes. can choose to open or close. So we sure. opened it. He played guitar and I've got my ukulele and we would just jam all day mm-hmm. and then go and do our scene. You know, we'd wait for hours to do our scene and it was fun.
Yeah.
Was
you know those times. Honey wagons with the partition things? That means your agent is not doing a good job making
you're right.
you a deal.
You're right. That's true.
When you have a dressing room that you're sharing with a partition.
With a partition.
I've done it many, many times, and that's kind of what I had hoped for. I hope that one day in my career, you know, no partition.
Right.
Wall.
Right.
Wall. It can still be small, and it still is relatively small, but hey, wall.
Just a wall, right. Because those really aren't dressing rooms. They are bathrooms with a bench. Like you walk in, there's a toilet at the end, and there's like a little bed.
Yes, this is glamorous Hollywood, people. When you're just beginning and you know, you have a job or a low budget thing where they just don't have kind of reasonable things.
Right.
You just,
right.
You're given the perk that you have is kind of a private bathroom.
Right.
Which is your dressing room.
Mm-hmm.
And as Bob said, it is a rudimentary plastic toilet
uh-huh.
and a vinyl bench.
Right. And a lot of times the whole facility has a septic problem, so there's some sort of odor that's mm-hmm. wafting in.
But that's good. It's like Tommy Lasorda when he was talking to the minor league players, saying, "I'm glad the showers are cold. I'm glad it's uncomfortable for you because you're here to either work to get out of this or leave."
Right.
So
yep.
If there's anything that'll convince you to start writing and start working harder, it's a little plastic toilet and a vinyl bench.
That's right.
And sitting there for maybe 8 or 9 hours because they just called you in at 6:30 in the morning and they're not getting to you until the end of the day?
I had a scenario on the same movie that I'm talking about where I played ukulele all day. They called me in. I was on the schedule for that day. I got there early in the morning, got put off, didn't shoot. So I was just there for no reason all day. And then and it was way up in Santa Clarita. The next day, I get called from the AD saying, "Oh, Bob, I'm so sorry. You were supposed to come in today to shoot, but I didn't put you on the list, so we have to just cut that scene." It's like, come on. I mean, it wasn't a major scene. It wasn't totally necessary, but there was a joke that was funny that would have been mm-hmm. funny in the movie. So they just cut it.
But that's the expense of movie production is sometimes, if we don't get to Bob's scene, like the director and producer look at each other and go, do we really need Bob's joke
right
in there?
Right.
Because we would have to go all the way back into whatever set. You know, we have to go and we have to set up the candy store again and go back in there with the cameras. I'll tell you what. Yeah, that scene doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Give me the Sharpie. X.
Right.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
But and why I'm here talking to you is, I respect the fact that you work in so many different areas, because I think, you know, L.A., show business, hey, New York, whatever, show business is full of people kind of sitting in a chair who keep spinning the jackpot wheel.
Right.
Because it is. There is a jackpot wheel. And like the lottery, some people hit the jackpot.
Right.
But it's really, to me, watching a lot of things, it seems like a prescription for a pretty sad and unsuccessful life.
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting there and click, 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 click. Oh, no, again. Oh, that guy got it. You know, he's not very good. I saw him in this right. thing, whatever. As opposed to the guys who are, yes, you never know what's going to happen. You can hit the jackpot here. But in the meantime, you're just working.
You just do your thing.
You just work. You write.
Yeah.
And you write a song, or you write a script, or you write a sketch, or you shoot something to put on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
Or you are a creative person who is continually creating.
Yeah.
Not creating one thing and then using most of your energy building a pedestal for yourself to stand on to say, I made a thing.
That's such a common thing with one script screenwriters. Oh, my script that I wrote 5 years ago, I'm still having meetings on that. And, you know,
they ripped me off. That whole Spider-Man thing.
Yeah.
I came up with the whole buildings with a guy flying through the buildings and things exploding.
So I'm not going to write scripts anymore because that one didn't work out. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm constantly busy. I constantly have a million things going on. Am I constantly being paid for those things that I have going on? No. But, you know, hopefully, you know, one of those things will pop or, you know, something.
Has it been worth it?
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely.
Have you really enjoyed it? And it was like, I'm glad I packed the car, went from Spokane. I'm glad I came to L.A. from Seattle.
Well, here's the thing. I do what I absolutely love. I love, even though I say that writing's really hard, I do love that. I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it. I love writing. I love acting. I love performing stand-up comedy. There's nothing else that I would do that I love. And I do believe that I wouldn't be here if I didn't believe that at some point it will pay off and there won't be so much of a struggle, you know, constantly. I believe that there will be some sort of thing that I'll get where I'll go, okay, now it's not so hard as it's been the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Because you're at a big, nice management company and everything. You're represented by good people.
Yeah, yeah.
I
don't think that that's such a weird thing, being with a really great management company or agent, because...
How did you get with them?
Well, I'm not with them anymore, by the way. No, I'm not with them.
Glad I brought it up.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I actually still have... I like the guy. I've got a good relationship with him. But he saw me in a video and called me and said...
Okay.
He's a well-respected manager and he reps big people. But I think I got lost in the shuffle a little bit.
Right.
And they went through a thing where all their managers cut like their bottom, I don't know, five or six people or whatever.
Oh, they're doing it... And, not just your cut. I mean, they're doing it everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Literally, I mean, in this economy and in show business as everywhere. And studios say, well, we're not doing those four movies because it's just going to cost us money and we're not going to make enough money in the end. And the management right. companies or the agencies or whomever is saying, look, this ship is taking on water.
Yeah.
So we've just got to, whoever our top people are, we've got to schedule a lunch with them. And everything else is, you know,
and and that's what happened. There's a ton of people were dropped from that particular company. But what happened was, you know, I was pitching, like I would be at CBS pitching a TV show, you know, big producer, my manager and my writing partner on that particular show. You know, we're pitching a show. And then a few weeks later, it's, hey, Bob, I have to cut you. So sorry, you know. I mean, we had stuff going on.
Yeah.
We were pitching things around.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a rough thing, but you know, it doesn't. I was with them for several years, and I got a few good auditions, and I got SNL looked at me a few years in a row, mm-hmm. and but that, you know, that's about it. Anything that I did in those few years that were sort of big things were stuff that I got myself, not
right.
stuff that my great manager got me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's almost true everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, you have, congratulations, you have the ability to put something on your card or whatever, and people go like, oh, that's a good company. But really, go out and do all the work yourself.
Right,
just go
right.
ahead, get it done.
Right. And by the way, you know, I was bummed at not being with them anymore. This was months ago that I was dropped from them. I was really bummed. But the next week, I booked a commercial with George Clooney that I did. And then I booked back-to-back two movies.
I saw you on that. What commercial was that with George Clooney? I remember. Yeah.
It was for China. It was probably – you probably saw it on the internet because this was a Mercedes commercial for China.
Oh, okay.
And I played a paparazzi that was chasing Clooney down through Beverly Hills.
What other commercials have you been in?
A bunch of...
Huh? No. Did you introduce biscuits at Kentucky Fried Chicken? Because that's what I did.
Oh, that's
as
what you
the
did?
Podcast listeners know. But, you know, yeah.
Really?
People think, oh, just Back to the Future. No. Not just the future movie. No. Without me, no biscuits.
No biscuits. Wow.
KFC.
That's really impressive.
You're welcome.
And I'm glad it was KFC and not Chick-fil-A biscuits. So I don't want to be political here, but...
I don't politicize chicken sandwiches.
No.
It's fine.
It's just chicken,
It's a chicken sandwich. I mean, you know, God. Ay, 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 people.
It's a little ridiculous, isn't
it? Well, it's just, it's a chicken sandwich.
Yeah.
I think our becoming scandalized monitors are, I think they're getting a little out of control. I mean, for everybody, for whatever.
For all sides.
For all sides,
yeah.
Everywhere. I mean, that was only my take on the whole thing is I'm trying, you know, just to be less scandalized about things
right.
and
less,
just live
less
my
shocked.
Life. Exactly. I'm not living, you know, Facebook post to Facebook post.
Right.
You know, oh my God, what now? What? I just.
It takes a physical toll, doesn't it? The stress that people go through.
I think it actually does. And I think some of it is almost corporately manufactured to keep us in a fear-based, scandalized state.
Yeah.
So that we buy something.
So
that whatever.
We want them to
be
so afraid that they go shopping.
Exactly. Exactly. Just, I don't know what it is. Just so, at least as long as TV is showing us the way, that's
yes.
all I care about.
Yes, and the internet.
Is just show me the way to live. Apparently, it's being completely consumed with fear and just every day going, oh, look at that now. Oh, my, well, I have to put something on the internet about this.
Right. I have to do a meme on the internet.
Right.
I got to find a photograph.
I understand. And I'm not being cynical about it. But yes, people are suffering. Yes, we should reach out. The only way that I can reach out is like from myself. You know, I don't think clicking like on stuff is doing anything.
Right. Right. I'm not a like clicker. I am not a like clicker. I was chastised the other day for not clicking like. My ex-girlfriend, who I'm still close with, she asked if I had seen something she put on Facebook. I said, yeah, I like that. That was great. And she goes, you didn't like it. And I said, no, I do like it. I promise you I do. You didn't click like. You're not on the list of people that click like. I tend to delete messages that people, and it's always somebody that I don't personally know. I have a lot of people on my Facebook that I don't personally know, and some people will post weird stuff, and I just delete it, and I probably offend them when I do that. But
yeah, but they're asking you to get into their anger and scandalization and their fear or whatever, and just reflect it.
Yeah.
I don't think. Well, we're getting on a kind of Facebooky weird modern technology tangent here, but I think are people Facebook friends anymore, or are people just looking for Facebook mirrors? Because if you're not a mirror, then I just can't believe that you're not a mirror, and now I hate you.
You mean if
I mean they want just you to reflect whatever
to reflect
say.
Whatever they say,
whatever they say, just like it, believe like it, yeah. Say good for you, Teddy, and just keep on trucking.
Right.
Do not even say. Certainly, don't say. Do you really think you should be projecting this to the entire world through Facebook? I mean, this inner angst you're experiencing, or whatever.
Isn't that weird? Those people that are on any kind of social networking that post their really personal angst, like their breakups really going, and stuff, yes. that only it's like a narcissism where they think that the stuff that they're going through, everyone else must already know about, so they'll just start commenting on it. It's just weird.
I would say attempt. I think what people have done for maybe 6,000 years of recorded human history, just go to a body of water and look across it and think.
Yes.
I don't know. But just, you know, just projecting it onto Facebook. I don't know. It happened. I can't believe it happened. And I don't even want to talk about it.
Right. It's crazy.
Well, what happened, Bob? ! Exclamation point! Exclamation
that,
point!
That's always the thing. That or so, you know, somebody posting something like, they just cast me, and that's all they post. Just fishing for someone to go. What were you casting?
What is it? Great.
I can't talk about it. And then eventually, 10 posts down. Okay, I'm gonna be in Mad About You. This is when they were posting
exactly.
from years ago.
Shot it in 92. Looking forward to my 14-cent residual check. Just wanted everyone to know. If you TiVo, I'm Mad About You.
You know what's funny? In my head, I was thinking 2.5 Men. That's what I meant to say, but it came out as Mad About You.
Even funnier.
Which is way better.
Way better.
That's the stuff that I don't mean to say is way better than the stuff that I intend.
I always think you're way more funny accidentally.
Thank you.
than when you're on purpose. No, just you, Bob. Generally,
just,
people.
Yeah, just me.
Just you are funny, but if only you could get on stage and just say things by accident.
Accidentally. Accidentally do shit, which I do sometimes. Although I did, can I tell the story? Yeah, I can tell the story. I did a little thing on Mike and Molly, a little one-liner on Mike and Molly that, why can't I think of his name? James.
Jimmy Hong?
No.
Oh, I'm just trying to go through this Jimmy
Hong
story.
You were trying. The guy who's directed every sitcom.
James Widows.
James Widows? No, I have worked with Jamie Widows, though.
Jamie.
I have worked with him. Anyway, he directed Cheers and Taxi.
Burroughs.
And all these,
Jim Burroughs.
Jim Burroughs is directing. And so I have this one line, and I'm doing it like I did it in the audition, which is what you do when you get hired for a one-liner. You don't change that. And Jim comes up to me and he says, do it a little bit differently. I can't remember what he told me, but he gave me a different way to do it that was funny. And so I started doing it that way in rehearsals. And then the next day, Chuck Lorre is on set. Big Chuck Lorre. I've never met the guy. He's never spoken to me, but it's very exciting. And so the first thing that Chuck Lorre has ever said to me is, "You're doing the line wrong." Because I wasn't doing it as I was doing it. So now I've got Jim Burroughs, who told me to do it one way,
right.
Chuck telling me to do it the other way.
Two television giants, which is the position that an actor gets in.
Yeah.
And then on TV especially, you're going back to the set thinking, which powerful guy am I supposed to listen to?
Exactly. So you know what I did? Rather than I didn't want to say, well, Jim told me to do it this way. Go talk to him.
Which is what I would have done. just a little crying. Not real tears, but just the voice. Like, he told me I was supposed to do that.
Actually, that's the best way to do it, to sort of joke about it like that and kind of...
I was thinking that. I was thinking, as I was saying that other thing, that's probably what I would have done, is you're really on the spot, so you go Don Rickles.
Yes.
And you don't even know the guy, and he's a huge, powerful director, but you go, but you say, nice note, Burroughs. Thanks. Thanks for helping me out in front of Laurie. Thanks. You really helped me, Jim.
Right. So, yeah, something like that would have been brilliant. But what I did instead was I just went right in between the two.
Oh, yeah.
And both of them were happy. I mean, I didn't get any notes after that, but yeah. I went a little bit closer to what I did in the audition and a little bit of what Jim told me to do, and they were happy with that.
Right.
So.
Because usually in movies, the director runs how things are going to go in the scene.
Yes.
And he's the one you listen to.
Right.
In television, four people in suits could come up and tell you different things, and you don't even know who they are.
Exactly.
And you're just trying to figure out which is the president of show business.
Right.
I don't know what anyone needs or wants.
Right.
You know? And I've seen actors get fired over that.
Oh, yeah.
Get fired over it because by the end of the day, they're so confused, hearing so many different things, that they're it's wrecked.
Yeah.
Their performance that was wonderful in their audition has been wrecked by a bunch of people they don't even know, and they get fired. Like, oh, she just didn't, you know, she just didn't bring it together. I guess the audition was good, but just couldn't, you know, and you're thinking, you jerks.
Yeah.
You just wrecked your performance over the span of one day.
Right. You got a writer telling her something, you got the showrunner telling her something, the director.
Exactly.
An AD.
So we went off on a tangent, but you would say to people, don't take a stand-up class, take an acting class.
Do some sort of writing.
Start writing.
I never took a writing class, and I feel like maybe I should have, but I did read a lot of those writing books, and, mm-hmm. and they're good, but you get to the point where they're all saying pretty much the same thing,
right.
and just in a different way.
And apparently, if you're any indication, make videos.
Make videos,
do
yeah.
Just get out there.
That's writing. I write scripts yeah. for all these videos that I do, and that's how I started. I would write these little short video scripts, and we would improvise within the script, but that's how that happened. And then I would write TV shows. When I was with this other manager, we developed a number of TV shows. So I wrote some TV scripts and a number of feature film scripts, you know.
Great. Where can people find out about you?
Well, they can find me on...
Are you still going house to house?
I'm still going house to house.
Well, that's good. So they can wait.
Yep.
They can have a very long wait and maybe cross their fingers.
Wait till I ring that doorbell.
Or they could fill your Facebook page with scandalous... Fear-based shrieking.
Please do. Even though I said that about Facebook, I'll friend people on Facebook. You know, facebook.com/Bob Bledsoe.
Bledsoe, B-L-E-D-S-O-E.
Yes. My website is bobbledsoe.com, so B-O-B-B-L-E-D-S-O-E.
Okay.
And then, like I said, I have a couple of YouTube channels, but youtube.com/Bob Bledsoe, but youtube.com/theprogramshow is where those sketches are. That's where I put up all my sketches.
Go there. All right. Are Mom and Dad proud?
Mom and Dad are proud. They're proud folks.
Are they happy when you get things? They, you know, they're still tuning in to that whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. They always watch and they're
Mike
excited.
And Molly.
They watch the kids show. You know, I do a lot of kids shows. I do the Disney shows, Nickelodeon uh-huh. shows, and they'll watch those. They'll watch an entire, you know, sort of live action cartoon to see their son.
Well, good. I'm glad. Hey, it's a pleasure talking to you, Bob.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Tom.
Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you.
So that's Bob. That's really what we do, what so many people who are making a living and doing well do here in Hollywood when they give up their job as a mortgage broker in Spokane, Washington, go to Seattle, start writing comedy because they just thought it would be maybe more fun, more exciting, and end up coming to Los Angeles into the big Shark Tank to try to survive. And Bob's been more than surviving. Bob's doing very well. So, hey, thanks so much. Thanks so much for downloading the podcast. If you haven't subscribed, consider subscribing or telling a friend. Thanks to Chris and Katie, everybody over at Nerdist. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for all their help in my live show. But as always, hey, thanks. Thanks for your emails. Thanks for your feedback. I appreciate it a lot. And I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.